I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. The fight over disclosing the list of donors paying for the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia moves to the courtroom. As WHYY's Bobby Allen reports, the DNC host committee opposes an effort by journalists to find out how much the public may have to pay for the convention, now just 1 week away.
Convention planners say hosting the DNC over 4 days will cost around $64 million. As a stopgap measure, the city extended a $15 million line of credit. Those taxpayer dollars will be used only if private fundraising lags. Freelance journalist Dustin Slaughter is now suing for the records. He says without the list of donors, it's unclear how much taxpayers could be on the hook for.
And it's important to know who the people are behind the curtain or the companies that may be influencing the next president of the United States and the Democratic Party.
DNC officials say they're just $3 million short of their fundraising goal. And they say they can't release the donor list because it contains, quote, proprietary information. Court brawl aside, the host committee is required by federal law to reveal its donors 2 months after the convention. But some say they shouldn't have to wait. For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
Miles of broadcast cable and thousands of sheets of plywood, not to mention balloons and confetti, are just some of the commodities that will be left over after the Republican National Convention wraps up later this month. Kevin Niedermeyer from member station WKSU in Kent, Ohio, reports that an environmentally friendly ending is being planned for most of it.
Carpenters and electricians are racing to transform the inside of Quicken Loans Arena from a basketball venue to a political epicenter by July 18th. As the stage rises at midcourt, Greg Lane of Freeman, the company that has set up Republican National Convention since 1984, talks about some of what's going into the transformation.
We're probably going to have 2,000, maybe 2,500 sheets of plywood, maybe more than that.
Lane says after the RNC, most of this plywood will be reused for other conventions Freeman creates.
A lot of it's not nailed in, it's screwed in, so we can take those out and repurpose that plywood afterwards. I mean, there's certainly some smaller pieces that are custom and stuff, but a small percentage of it, you know, probably 15-20%, can't be reused. But we do have some local recyclers, I think, that are working with the building and us to even take those kind of that and paper products for recycling.
And there'll be plenty of leftover paper and balloons. Dave O'Neill is deputy press secretary for the RNC.
We have about 125,000 balloons that will drop that will need to be cleaned up. We have about 1,000 pounds of confetti that will be dropped that will be need to cleaned up. And all of that material, the paper that you mentioned, you know, for handouts and things of that nature, it won't simply be thrown away. It'll be recycled.
Some things are easier to recycle than others. Greg Lane with the Freeman Company says much of the equipment they use, like electrical cables and connections and scaffolding for lights, are designed to be reused. But he says big media events like the RNC pose some special challenges.
The cable for the media, the signal cable and video and sound, that's more difficult to take out and repurpose again. But we do have a company that comes in, and we end up cutting that into sections to try to get it out because the bundles are so big.
For items like this, Lane says Freeman contracts with local recyclers. Diane Bickett is head of the Cuyahoga County Solid Waste District. She's talked with Lane about some possible collaborations.
Well, that's a very recyclable item. We have companies like FPT Cleveland that could take that cable and put it through a shredder. And through their sortation processing, they could separate the copper and all the good metals out of that material and recycle that material. So that's an easy one. We're doing that now with computer cables and things of that nature.
And Bickett says the Solid Waste District can help organizations hold events that generate virtually no waste.
Everything from small block clubs to larger events, they get quite challenging. The more people you have, obviously, but those types of events usually have a waste reduction component, sort of planning ahead so you're not creating waste on the back end, putting good recycling systems in places, putting people at the recycling stations and the trash cans to make sure people are sorting properly.
And Bickett says the district can also recommend a recycling company to handle the carpeting, which Freeman's Greg Lane says it recycles after it's too worn to use for other conventions. Lane says there are two reasons his company tries to avoid using the landfill.
70% of the things that we use to build out an environment like this for an experience for a customer, we repurpose and reuse or re-rent and recycle. So we're doing that as part of the environment, but it's just economically smart to do that. That's just how we run the business.
Lane says the 30% of materials they can't reuse or recycle include unrecyclable plastics, styrofoam, and other odds and ends. He expects to contract with local recycling companies this week who can take care of the other items like broadcast cable and carpeting. Quicken Loans Arena already has recyclers that deal with paper and balloons. For WHYY News, I'm Kevin Niedermeyer in Cleveland.
In the wake of the death of five Dallas police officers, President Barack Obama said that Americans have cause to wonder if the divides of race can ever be bridged. Let's take up the topic with Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup poll. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Dave.
Frank, the president also urged Americans to reject such despair.
Well, I think that when the president made that exhortation in Dallas about rejecting despair, he was fitting in with where public opinion had been at least prior to the Dallas incident. We don't have an update on these measures since then, but actually we were in the field with our major minority rights poll all through the month of June, where we have oversamples of blacks and Hispanics so we can look in depth at their attitudes. And I can say, putting it all together, through July 1st, we did have signs of optimism. A clear majority of Americans said that they did think that a solution to the problem between black and white relations would eventually be found. The problem would be worked out rather than the alternative we gave them, which is it will always be a problem. And that's a question that we and other pollsters have been asking going all the way back to the 60s.
How does that optimism, though, break down by race?
Well, whites are more optimistic than blacks. The majority of whites are optimistic, and that drives the overall numbers. Blacks are slightly less than 50% are optimistic that a solution will be eventually worked out, but it's not too far below 50%. So there's some optimism on the part of both sides, although it's by no means overwhelming. But I should point out there have been previous points in time when optimism was significantly lower that a solution would ever be worked out. I'll give you one example. After the O.J. Simpson verdict was handed down back in October of 1995, same question we asked that, and the percent of Americans who said a solution to black-white problems would ever be worked out was down to below 30%. So we're clearly more optimistic than at times in the past.
Is there a bigger white-black gulf in terms of attitudes related to policing?
That's a constant. There's no question that there is a gulf, a separate set of lenses through which whites and blacks look at police in America today. When we look at the fairness of the criminal justice system, when we look at questions which say, are blacks treated less fairly than whites by police, we find that whites are significantly more positive than blacks.
And toward that end, to what extent do blacks report having had a negative encounter with police?
Interesting question that we do ask, but we phrase it within 30 days, Dave. In the last 30 days, have you had a negative encounter with police, such as in traffic incidents? That's the wording that we use. And 16% of Americans who identify their race as black in our June survey said, yes, they had within the last 30 days. Now, I should point out that 16% data is actually down some. We had had it up in the 25%, 20% range earlier in the last decade. So that number over the last several years actually is lower than it has been.
Frank, we are now less than 72 hours out from the Republican National Convention in Cleveland. Let's talk about the convention bump.
Well, there are bounces and there are bounces. There's no question about it that, generally speaking, when a party and a candidate gets all the attention, has the media focus on them when they're in their four-day convention, they typically come out the other end looking better than they did going in. Looking at various indicators, including who would you vote for, has been about a 5-point bounce overall. So the Trump campaign presumably is hoping that the same kind of thing will happen for him.
Though if we're talking about a bounce rather than a launch, it implies you come back down to earth. Will that bounce be negated 1 week out when the Democratic National Convention gets underway?
Excellent question, and typically it is. So Hillary Clinton goes last, the recency effect, we call it, rather than the primacy effect. What that all means is that it doesn't mean much, typically.
It is only July, and so much can change between now and November.
That is absolutely correct. Although, when we look at the images of these candidates, and I've just been reviewing Trump, it's remarkable how stable his image has been. You can say this is an incredibly tumultuous time for Donald Trump over the last year. All the things that he's said and done and the controversies. But when we look at the percent of Americans who like him and who don't like him, it's like a railroad tracks, a very, very straight line, generally speaking, over the last year.
But is stability synonymous with a ceiling? Can he grow his appeal?
He has not been able to so far. His appeal has stayed in the 30 to 35% range by appeal. I don't mean would you vote for him. I mean, do you like the guy? You have a favorable opinion of Donald Trump. And again, 30 to 35%, and that's been fairly constant the entire year. Over 60%, generally speaking, have an unfavorable opinion of Donald Trump. We'll see what happens going forward.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on Newsworks Tonight. Still ahead this evening, first-generation college students reflect after making it through their first year.
It kind of hit me knowing that I was the one in college and they look up to me. So.
And you were the one with the answers. Like, no one else had those answers.
Yeah, like, I mean, the spotlight was on me and everyone was, I mean, they're proud of me.
NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY. Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. Last week's tragic deaths of Philando Castile, Alton Sterling, and five Dallas police officers have fueled debates regarding racial justice in America. Many choose to channel their outrage through advocacy groups like Black Lives Matter or the pro-police movement Blue Lives Matter. But for WHYY's J. Scott Smith, it's not as easy as picking a side.
That could have been me. It's a feeling I've gotten to know far too well. The killings of Alton Sterling and Philando Castile, followed by the senseless massacre of five Dallas police officers, left me with that familiar reminder that only fate and timing have kept me from the pain and grief that comes in moments like this. I say that not just because I'm a black man. I'm also the son of a police officer. Now, I have every reason to be angry and distrustful of police, but I also know the sacrifices a good cop makes in their life. I've not known a day in my life when that fear of loss, of my father being killed in the line of duty, of me being killed by a cop, hasn't chased me. I've sat in my car with those lights flashing in the rearview, cautiously preparing my license and registration before the officer reaches my door. I've been pulled over for going 40 in a 45-mile-per-hour zone and followed around Michigan State University late at night after stopping at a Burger King. What those who dismissively say all lives matter and blue lives matter don't seem to get is that people of color are operating under a different set of societal norms. Castile's death struck a particular chord with me. It made me think of every time a cop has stopped me. What if I made the wrong move while reaching for my license? What if I, quote, fit the description and a cop killed me? Please understand that every morning from when I was in preschool to the day I left for college, I saw my dad walk out the door wearing his police uniform, never quite sure if he'd walk back through that afternoon. He joined the Detroit police in 1973, working not far from the neighborhood where he grew up. The department was still rife with racism as the city finally made efforts to integrate it following the 1967 riots. My father and other black officers had to put up with racial slurs, all the while being called sellouts on the street by the people he was helping to protect. Now, as the years passed and the makeup of that department changed, he became more well-known and respected in the community and by the students at his alma mater, Southwestern High School, where he patrolled. Many to this day still call my dad Smitty, as opposed to Officer Smith. Now, he retired from the Detroit Police in 2005, but in his man's room, two items still stand out. A pair of framed photos of Officers Matthew Bowens and Jennifer Fettig, who were gunned down during a traffic stop on February 16, 2004. And now I know, in this current climate, it dictates that I must pick a side. You're either pro-police or you're pro-black lives, as if the two are mutually exclusive. Micah Johnson, to me, is no different from Charleston shooter Dylann Roof. He was a deranged, cowardly, hateful individual who used Castile and Sterling's deaths as an excuse. He's nothing more than an American terrorist. But to the men in blue who truly want to protect us. It would be nice to see more of you condemn your fellow officers for recklessly harassing, beating, and killing black citizens as quickly as you are to condemn a crooked cop who took money or sold drugs. Also, could you and your unions not compare Black Lives Matter and other protesters to terrorists such as ISIS and the Ku Klux Klan? Last week was a brutal reminder of how much work is left to be done. Philando Castile and Alton Sterling's deaths are hell I'd wish on nobody's family. And it cuts especially deep because if not for fate, I could also have been the son of a slain officer trying to make sense of that sudden loss. I'm J. Scott Smith.
For the past year, WHYY education reporter Avi Wolfman-Aaron followed five first-generation college students from Delaware for our series, First Year, First Generation. With their freshman years now in the rearview mirror, it's a good opportunity to recap. Avi, are all five anticipating their sophomore seasons?
You know, throughout the year, a couple of the students flirted with the idea of dropping out. In the case of one student, Jackie White, she wasn't sure whether she'd be able to pay for her second semester. But everyone persevered. And I should say, as a slight caveat, that one of the students, Josie Lazar, decided that she's not going to go back for a bachelor's degree. She wants to get an associate's degree and become a nurse.
How were these five students chosen, and to what extent did you observe commonalities as the year progressed?
So I chose them based on the fact that they were all going to different types of schools, or at least on different tracks. I surveyed the entire state of Delaware talking to high school counselors to find these students. There were some patterns. At the beginning of the year, I noticed a lot of students were really homesick, and I noticed a lot of them going home every weekend. And midway through the year, that narrative really flipped. And that was really apparent to me in the story of Jada Smack, who goes to Swarthmore College, and she was making a big culture shift, and it certainly took time.
People around here like to use, like, SAT words to say things that are, like, simple. Like, instead of saying being aware of, people say being cognizant of and stuff like that. Sometimes it makes you kind of feel like you're not, like, as smart as other people or you don't belong here. But then if you just, like, take some time to, like, ask that person, oh, well, actually, what does that word mean? Then you start to talk like that, too.
You know, in the beginning, Jada was going home a lot more than I expected. But by the end of the school year, she almost didn't want to go home. And she ended up actually deciding to spend the summer at Swarthmore. She sort of needed that distance. She needed that space.
How did the students fare academically?
It was really a mixed bag. I had one student who was on the dean's list, Sierra Jefferson. I'll give her a shout out there. A couple other students hovered just under 3.0. They were decent but not great. And then I had another student who really struggled just to show up, go to class, turn in her assignments on time. And generally, one of the things I noticed is that the students really did this whole thing on their own. I mean, they knew that there were places on campus where they could go to turn for academic help, but none of them seemed eager to take advantage of them. And that's consistent with a lot of the research on first-generation students. They're less likely to reach out, ask for help when they need it.
Did the students discuss with you the extent to which they felt like first-generation students?
I think most days for them, you know, you go to school, you wake up, and you're just a college student. But yeah, one of the things I wanted to make sure to ask at the end of the project was if there was a moment during that whole year where you really felt like you were first generation. And one of the most interesting answers was from Sierra Jefferson, who's a student at Wesley College. And she told me about a moment when she got together with her family over winter break and all of her cousins, you know, gathered around her and started asking her questions about school.
It kind of hit me knowing that I was the one in college and they look up to me, so.
And you were the one with the answers. Like, no one else had those answers.
Yeah, like, I mean, the spotlight was on me, and everyone was, I mean, they're proud of me.
Avi, were there any surprises for you along the way in terms of perhaps preconceived notions you had going into the project?
Yeah, I was expecting there to be sort of like big breakpoint moments where there was a big obstacle. And to me, it was more like 1,000 paper cuts. You know, there were these little obstacles every day. How do I replace this phone? How do I get a new computer? Because mine's acting up. For one of the students, Sean Ryan, who I mentioned earlier, the constant pressure of feeling like he wasn't getting it in school academically really built up. And there were points where he said, I'm going to finish out the year, but I don't think I could come back. He eventually pushed through that and he sort of psyched himself up to get through that. But there wasn't one big calamity. It just built up over time.
To what extent did these students feel that there were school services available to them in terms of figuring out how to proceed?
They would tell me that they were aware of those things, but at the end of the year, I didn't get the sense that, with maybe one exception, they'd built any really close relationships with sort of staff support.
Thanks, Avi.
Thanks, Dave.
WHYY education reporter Avi Wolfman-Arendt. You can hear more of our conversation at newsworks.org. That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov and Kimberly Haas, with additional production this week from Ty Johnson and Brett Rader. We had help this week from our intern, Edward Saakashvili. Our news director is Eugene Song. At the helm this week, Diana Martinez and Adam Stanishevsky. John Mussoni is acting vice president of news and civic dialogue. Listen again to a story or catch up on a missed show via podcast or online at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us and have a great weekend. I'm Dave Heller for Newsworks Tonight.